And I should mention, actually, before I get started, because you mentioned Carl Truman's book, Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. Terrific, terrific book. Carl is actually coming to my church in Bozeman on the 26th and 27th.
Say that again one more, three more times. 26th
and 27th of April in Bozeman at Trinity Church. He'll be there, and actually the guy who wrote the introduction to that book, my tenuous connection to greatness on this, Rod Dreher, also provided a very kind endorsement of my
book. It's interesting. Do you know how many books he's writing? The foreword, this guy is really worth it. So
yeah.
26th and 27th in Bozeman.
In Bozeman at Trinity Church.
You can write that down on your program and I'll shut up.
You know, it's something my church is putting on, but everybody's welcome.
So. He is the best.
So that's so terrific.
Second best.
Well, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be out here and really appreciate everybody coming out. What I'm going to start off doing tonight is just kind of giving an overview of my book. It's not going to be a book talk because I think that would just kind of be boring. But I'm going to kind of give you an overview of the things I talk about in the book and why it's important. So let's see. So who am I? We touched on this just a little bit. I'm a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. I'm author of The Unprotected Class. By the way, some of you came up earlier. A couple of you seem to already have gotten into reading it, which is impressive. By the way, I should mention, you guys are the first people in the world to have this book. My publisher doesn't even have it yet. These were shipped here directly from the printer. It does not actually get officially published until the 23rd of April. And so there's sort of two good things about that. At first, you guys are the first people in the world who will actually be seeing this, other than the people who kind of read draft copies and were kind enough to provide their endorsements. Secondly, everything that I'm presenting tonight, I'm going to let you in on a little bit of a secret of how people in my business kind of work, which is you sort of, you know, you have some presentations that you do, and you go around and you give different versions of those presentations. You modify them a little bit for whatever audience you're in front of, but you kind of got your shtick, as it were. So this is all new. So I put everything here together for this. I will, of course, be modifying this in the future as I speak to other audiences. So the good news for you guys is that you guys are the first people to hear this. The other news, of course, is that there'll be some bumps in the road. So just bear with me while we do that. So I served in the Trump administration. I was Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Interior. I have a whole other previous life kind of in environment and energy policy that has nothing to do with the subject of this book, which sort of became an avocation that really became something I felt compelled to do after praying on it. I was also appointed by Trump to the National Board of Education Sciences. I was at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. We touched on some of the things I did, and then, as I mentioned, I go to Trinity Church, which is a Presbyterian Church in America church out in Bozeman, and I'm a growth group leader there, and we're actually reading Carl Truman's book in my growth group right now in preparation for his coming to our church. So I mean, at least some of the people at my church are going to be well prepared to talk about it. So what I'm going to talk about today is this overview of anti-white racism, and I'll be discussing kind of how that manifests itself in a variety of areas of American life. Then I'm going to talk about the church. That's going to be a sort of shorter presentation than this one. I think this one will probably take up most of the conversation. And I'd love to have a conversation back and forth with you a little bit about what it's looking like in your churches to the degree. I think things are a little different in Montana. Tomorrow we're going to look at immigration, and we'll also talk about a biblical view of immigration, although that's not going to be the sole focus. And then we're going to kind of talk about like what the anti-white left, at least in my view, has planned, and how we can fight back against it. And as I touched on here, the secret, which is not actually a secret because I just told you, everything here is new. So again, just a little patience. So again, Claremont, we were founded in 1979. We're a big national conservative think tank, but we're very distributed, which is why I'm fortunate enough to be able to work out of my house in Bozeman with occasional trips to DC. And our mission is to restore the principles of the American founding to their rightful preeminent authority in national life. We're probably best known right now. My fellow senior fellow, John Eastman, was President Trump's lead lawyer in the election and has had just brutal lawfare sicked on him. He was disbarred in California. This is a guy who was a clerk for Justice Thomas at the Supreme Court. He was a law school dean, very, very distinguished constitutional scholar. But because he stepped forward on behalf of Trump, they've just waged war against him. So that's probably not a shock to some of you, but he's probably, unfortunately become famous or infamous. And we've gotten a lot of attention recently and recognized by President Trump and others. What we do, again, I'm not going to spend too much time on Claremont, but we teach. We do a lot of seminars. We teach a lot of young leaders. We've had federal judges. We actually have programs for sheriffs, all sorts of things. We try to teach them constitutional principles. We litigate. John Eastman is the head of our litigation center, and still, because he's barred, thankfully, in other states besides California. We lead. We've been very involved in pushing innovative policy proposals in a variety of areas. And we write, and that's what I'm here to talk to you about today. So that's that part of the thing. So in the beginning, this is not going to be as grandiose of an in the beginning as the true in the beginning, but I'm just going to read you a little bit from my book, and this will actually save you, and you can decide whether it's worth 10 copies or not. But I'm just going to read the first few pages of the book, with skipping over just a little bit, just kind of give you a sense and say the ground. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey knelt before George Floyd's 24-karat gold-plated casket and wept. His body heaved as though he were mourning the loss of his own son. A week earlier, Floyd, a small to medium-time career criminal who had once held the gun to the belly of a woman in front of her toddler during a home invasion, had died in the course of an arrest. Floyd was high in methamphetamine at the time and had 3 to 4 times what would be considered a lethal dose of fentanyl in his system. The now well-known events that led to Floyd's death began when Floyd was accused by a local store owner of passing a counterfeit bill. The police were called, and among those who responded was Derek Chauvin, a white officer. Floyd, who was African-American, would soon utter his famous comment, "I can't breathe," numerous times before police even touched him. Difficulty breathing is a common side effect of fentanyl intoxication. After Floyd resisted arrest, Chauvin knelt on his neck for an extended period. A jury would later determine, amid a politically tense trial, that this had caused Floyd's death, leading to a conviction of Chauvin on account of second-degree murder. The Chauvin trial took place in the wake of the most financially destructive riots in American history, which killed at least 19 people, led to 17,000 arrests, and injured more than 2,000 officers, and gave rise to more than 2,400 incidents of looting. In total, rioters caused more than $2 billion in damage. Of course, one was not permitted to ask whether Chauvin received a fair trial, or whether the jury was swayed by days of deadly riots, overt threats of violence, and massive demonstrations just outside the courthouse. As one prospective juror explained about his reluctance to serve, "It's more from a safety security standpoint. I just wouldn't want any issues or harm to come to my wife or family." Regardless of your opinion on whether the jury got it right, the broader context of the trial was apparent to many. As commentator Tucker Carlson noted at the time, Americans have been told that George Floyd's death was a racist murder, and they're responsible for it. Grace Church School in Manhattan, tuition and fees approximately $63,000 per year, was one of the many ferociously competitive schools that served the children of New York City's elite. Like its brethren, after George Floyd's death, Grace Church embraced an anti-racist curriculum that included separating white students into groups that didn't include non-whites. At Manhattan's ultra-elite Dalton School, the interim school director wrote a, in quotes, racial biography interrogating her own white privilege. Over 100 students at Dalton proposed an anti-racism curriculum in which any gap between black and non-black students advanced in course performance would have led to course cancellation. The equally Tony Brearley School added a mandatory anti-racism training for all students and staff. These measures were not enough for some. A prominent diversity consultant attacked the schools for having, in quotes, insidious whiteness, and, in quotes, being built to replicate the plantation mentality. He compared some white parents at Dalton, opposed to his race-based policies, to those who attacked the Capitol building on January 6th. As the head of Grace Church School put it in a secretly recorded conversation in 2021, "We're demonizing white people for even being born. We're using language that makes them feel less than others and for nothing that they are personally responsible for." Despite this, policies have not changed, and in fact, most elite schools have doubled down on their anti-white rhetoric. Examinations of the class privilege of those parents who can afford to shell out $60,000 plus per year for school tuition are somewhat more difficult to come by. The George Floyd trial and anti-racism curricula in our schools are very different issues, but they are tied together by a common thread. The stigmatization of white Americans and, in quotes, whiteness in the service of justifying blatant racial discrimination. White Americans are increasingly second-class citizens in a country their ancestors founded and in which, until recently, they were the overwhelming majority of the population. We've come a long way from the days in which we were securing the blessings of liberty for ourselves and our posterity, as the preamble to the Constitution put it. How did we get here? How did the Civil Rights Revolution, begun with largely sincere intentions, run so badly off the rails? How can we correct course? And why is it necessary to do so? It is to these questions that this book is dedicated. So that's kind of an overview of what you'll kind of get if you read the book. I skipped over a little bit of the detail on Floyd, but that kind of sets up the whole talk nicely, hopefully. This was touched on a little bit when Dick was making his introductory remarks about my reluctance to write this book. And it was a little bit between Exodus 4 and the book of Jonah, without making any personal comparisons to myself and any of the heroes there. Exodus 4, as many of you know, is when Moses is arguing with God about how he really doesn't want to lead the Israelites. And finally, God just says, shut up, you're going to do it. That was not the exact verse, by the way. But and when he says that he's not eloquent enough, he says, well, you know, I'm going to make your brother Aaron do it. Similarly, the book of Jonah, God tells Jonah that he needs to go to Nineveh and tell them to mend their ways. Jonah, of course, defies that. The kind of parallel in my life was that I went to the Trump administration thinking I could just do the work that I was expert in and sort of leave some of these issues that had been preoccupying me behind. And in fact, the left and the media, you know, proceeded to, in very prominent ways, make sure that I had to talk about these issues that had nothing to do with my job. And so that, metaphorically for me, was my time that I tried to avoid going to Nineveh. That was the big fish that swallowed me and spit me back out. And once I left the administration, when the Trump administration ended, I realized that after a lot of prayer that even though I felt like there were people who were more eloquent of speech, et cetera, who could write this book, that God was calling me in whatever small way to do this. And so that's why I wrote it. So why did I need to go to Nineveh? This graph is kind of useful. So in 1965, there was a really big immigration bill called Hart-Celler. And essentially, everything that we have in contemporary immigration policy is a result of the Hart-Celler bill that totally transformed the demographics of the United States. And I'm just kind of giving you a sense. So in 1960, the Hispanic population of the United States was a few million, and 80% of them were U.S. born. Many of them had actually been here for hundreds of years, and in some cases predating the United States, and if, you know, in places like San Antonio and the Californias and Southern California. Asian American population, again, really, really tiny. The black immigrant population did not get lift off that graph. It was just so small you can't even see it. And now you have 63 million or so Hispanics. You have 25 million or so Asian Americans, and even a black immigrant population of several million, which has grown a lot. So I'm going to talk about that more when I talk about the immigration slide. But essentially, America is in the midst of a vast demographic transformation. And the decisions we make about how we're going to handle that transformation will determine our success as a multicultural country. So there are a few questions, and I ask these questions in my book, but I'm just going to present them to you right now as an audience. What happens when those who are largely the group kind of largely responsible for building American society, for better and worse, okay, and its institutions, goes from a dominant position, which white Americans had traditionally had in the United States, to just being one group among many, and a legally and culturally disfavored group at that? What does a post-white America look like, especially when that post-white America actively denigrates much of the cultural, political, and social legacy that built the country? And can America and its institutions survive that kind of a transformation? And how do we avoid, ultimately, the civil strife that has happened in so many other multi-ethnic countries around the world? It's just been an epidemic. I mean, kind of everywhere. Not it's not universal, but it's very frequent. So how do we avoid that here? Now, we're just beginning to see these sorts of changes in Montana. That's why it's sort of, this is the beginning again. I'm going to be on the road for like 11 of the next 13 days in Texas and in Arizona and all these other places giving talks like this. But in Montana, I think it's particularly interesting because we're just kind of beginning to see this. And in some ways, demographically, we're kind of the old America in many ways. Our biggest minority group in this state is Native Americans, of which, of course, we have many in around this area. We are one of only three states for whom that's true. The others are the Dakotas. We have, I think, the 49th or 50th out of 50 states in percentage of Asian Americans and African Americans, and we have a bigger but still pretty small Hispanic population. So and a multiracial population. So we're diversifying. I mean, we're more diverse than Montana was 40, 50 years ago. But still, in many ways, like our demographics are a little bit like America before Hartzeller. When America gained its independence, of course, our demographics were radically different. And I haven't even used the same things on the key here because it wouldn't make sense. So essentially, the overwhelming majority of the population, about 85%, of the free citizen population, I should add. I'm not trying to erase the roughly 10% of people living in America at that time who were African American, but very few of them were free African Americans at the time by percentage, so they didn't have citizenship. But of the citizen population, it was overwhelmingly British, okay? And then there was about 9% who were German, and you can kind of go back and see Ben Franklin worrying about the German threat to Americanness, which is why I think it's important not to kind of go overboard with some of these critiques of multiculturalism, because you can kind of see we've had these sorts of things before. And then we had some Dutch, some French, whatever else. But the point is, we were, at least by the standards of today, a very, very demographically uniform country at the time of independence. So now let's fast forward to 1950, and I've now kind of put forward, I've sort of compressed all of the various people from European countries into one and just treated them white because that's how they're treated in the census. But you still see this is kind of pre-Hartzeller world. 88% white, 10% African American, and everything else is sort of so small that you almost can't see it. Again, I mean, you have these small legacy Hispanic populations. But this is in the lifetime, or at least close to the lifetime, probably, of some of the older people in this room, right? That America looked like this. So we've had a dramatic, dramatic transformation in our demographics. And I'm going to show you what that looks like in this next slide. So here we are today. This is what U.S. demographics look like today. We're about 58% white non-Hispanic. We are 19% Hispanic, about 13.5% African American. The Hispanic population has continued to grow. The African American population has grown slightly, but is relatively stable. Asian American population is about 6% and has grown a lot. The multiracial population is still small, but that's actually the one that has grown the most. The average age of multiracial Americans are less than 21 years old. So in many ways, that's kind of the future that we're heading to, and there's actually a lot of possibility in that. I'm not saying that this is necessarily, none of these things I'm suggesting, I'm just putting out their changes. There are positive and negative elements of these changes, but I'm just trying to point out how different things have become in a relatively brief window of time. You see this even more if you look at the U.S. demographics of those under 18 today. So when you look at under 18, it's actually, we're already a minority white non-Hispanic country. I think it's like 48 or 49%. Hispanics are near a quarter. You see the multiracial American, I think, is like roughly 6%, which is similar to the Asian American percentage. And then you have Native Americans. The population, by the way, is also of that, as a percentage of population, has gone up like 10x since the 1970s. That does not indicate, by the way, a huge fertility explosion among Native Americans. It's because it's become both formally and informally more advantageous to identify yourself as Native American if you have some Native American ancestry. I think it tells you a lot about the cultural moment we're in. I'll talk about that more when I go into my immigration slide, but I just want to call that out because I think it's interesting when you hear people talk about white privilege. And again, I go into this much more in the book, but instead what you really had is a flight from white. Anybody who can identify as something other than white typically does, at least certainly in a legal context. Sometimes maybe they want to identify as white in a social context, but in a legal context, almost never, because there's no advantage to it. So I'm now going to give an outline of my argument here a little bit, and I'm going to go through kind of chapter by chapter some of the things that the book talks about. I'm going to leave off the church and the immigration chapters, because I'm going to be talking about the church next. I'm going to talk about the church just anyway. I'll just that's kind of how I do it. But most of the other subjects here, I'm going to kind of cover. So first of all, what are protected classes? I called my book The Unprotected Class. This was not my choice of title. Those of you who've, if you ever published a book, things like titles and covers are a subject of constant negotiation with your publisher. I had wanted to call my book title It's Okay to Be White. That was a little too spicy. Actually, the editorial staff got behind that. They were like, okay. We could do that. And then the people who wanted to sell my book to Costco said, no, you can't do that, Jeremy, sorry. So we went with this more academic title, which I do talk about, and it's called The Unprotected Class. So if you have a familiarity with civil rights law in the United States, there's a concept called protected classes within it. And I've sort of listed here what some of those protected classes are. Race, this is not comprehensive, by the way, there's a lot, but race, age, disability, religion, color, sex, sexual orientation. You cannot discriminate against anybody because of their status in a protected class. That is a result of our civil rights law. Now, in theory, this actually applies to whites as well. But in practice, it almost never does. And in fact, so in theory, you can't discriminate against white people for being white. In practice, and I show this again and again in my book, but you don't even need to read the book for that, because if you just have your eyes open, everything from job opportunities to how affirmative action was done in school, the Supreme Court just ruled on that. I can talk a little bit later about why I don't think that will be as effective as we might hope it would be. But there's just blatant anti-white discrimination that is going on. What is interesting and what has happened, started to happen, Stephen Miller, who ran the Domestic Policy Council under President Trump, when he left, he started a group called America First Legal and done really fantastic work. I think it's really the best group that's come out of the Trump administration. They're not the only people who've done this, but they have been the most effective group at actually identifying just like blatantly illegal and unconstitutional anti-white discrimination that's been going on in plain sight of everybody, and nobody's been doing anything about it, and suing. And what's happening is they're going to win. In fact, they've already won some of these because there's really no argument on the merits. I mean, it's like you can't do that. But they've been doing it, and white people have kind of been allowing them to do it. So in theory, again, whites are a protected class, but in practice, they're sort of an unprotected class. So I talk a lot about the history of civil rights law, and in this book, you can get a little bit too much into that. There's some other people who've touched around this. Nobody's written as directly on this subject as I have, but there are people who've written around this subject recently. And a lot of them, I think, correctly point to the centrality of our civil rights laws in enabling the sort of environment that we're in today. I think you can go too far with that type of argument, in that I think if you eliminated every single civil rights law in this country, you would still have a lot of the same formal and informal dynamics going on. I think they're kind of baked into the cake at this point. But I do think it's true that there are plenty of these things that do happen as a result of these civil rights laws. So the first prominent one is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This was the most heavily contested Civil Rights Act. In practice, it did a lot of really good things, at least in the short term, that are really hard to argue against. I mean, there were clear legal disabilities, particularly against African Americans, but not exclusively, that were going on that should have just been illegal. And so this was an attempt to use a fairly blunt instrument to make them illegal, whether those be around voting or public accommodations or what have you. so that was a bitterly contested law, particularly among Southern senators who did not like that idea, but it was passed, and that was a really transformative thing. And in fact, so much so that a Claremont colleague of mine, who's sort of written a book about this, kind of calls it America's second constitution. And I don't think that that's an exaggeration. Then under President George H.W. Bush, we got the Civil Rights Law of 1991. And this, again, I don't want to get too into the nerdy weeds of what this looks like, but what it did is it gave a lot more teeth to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It made it much easier to move things into favorable court jurisdictions, to get jury trials for discrimination, to do a variety of things that essentially, you know, in my view, were not necessary and kind of put too much onus, made it too easy to claim discrimination where no discrimination really was going on, and as a result kind of led to a bunch of unintended consequences. So before the Civil Rights Act of 1991, and partially something it was in reaction to, was a case called Griggs versus Duke Power. And that happened in 1971. I've written on Griggs extensively. I mentioned a little bit in the book. Griggs was one of the most important Supreme Court cases that ever happened. I mean, it's not quite at the level of Roe v. Wade, but it was almost at that level. And yet, everybody knew Roe v. Wade. Nobody knows Griggs, unless you're like an academic or something. Griggs did something that the people, when they passed the Civil Rights Act, promised that you wouldn't do. If you go back to the legislative debates around the Civil Rights Act, various people raised objections, and the people who were trying to get it passed said, oh, no, we'd never do that. And I actually think some of them, maybe even most of them, were saying that in good faith. But 7 years later, kind of due to the kind of logic, internal logic of government, in fact, we were doing just that. And so Griggs versus Duke Power established a concept called disparate impact. And what disparate impact basically does is if you have a hiring process, Duke Power was I grew up in North Carolina. Duke Power was my power company growing up. They had a hiring process, and there was no racial bias alleged intentionally in that hiring process. But what they did show, the plaintiffs in this case, was that the hiring process led to it being much more likely that a white person would be hired, okay? And so the issue at stake in Griggs versus Duke Power is, if you had a reasonable job application or something similar in which it could be shown that no discrimination was alleged, but you didn't come out with a roughly perfectly proportional outcome by race, could the employer be held liable? And what the Supreme Court decided in Griggs versus Duke Power was yes. And that was called disparate impact. So it said if it has a disparate impact on not just race, but it's primarily race, any group, then it's prima facie illegal. And so as you can imagine, this opened up the door for all sorts of mischief, right? Because there's all sorts of ways in which it's almost impossible to devise a test that doesn't discriminate overtly by race that would kind of wind up with something equal. And in fact, there's an independent member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, not the one who wrote an endorsement for my book, who's the longest serving African American on that commission, but another woman, she's a law professor, and she wrote a book, or she wrote a long law review article called roughly Disparate Impact Law Makes Everything Presumptively Illegal. And I think that's basically the case. So this is one of these cases where the Supreme Court did something that was so dumb and so out over their skis that in a case called Ward's Cove versus Antonio, I can't remember, like 15 years later, they effectively gutted Griggs. They kind of walked it back. And they said, again, this kind of gets too technical and boring, so I don't want to get into the details of it, but they basically said, whoa, okay, this was too much, it was dumb. You know, we're discriminating against white people here. The civil rights establishment threw a fit, okay? And George H.W. Bush was a very thoroughly decent man, but he was not maybe the toughest fighter. And in the context of, you know, and the media is screaming at you and we didn't have the internet to like fight back. And so again, long story short, there was a bunch of negotiations back and forth, but the Bush administration caved and basically rewrote Griggs versus Duke Power effectively back into our legal statutes as part of a compromise bill. So that's had all sorts of effect. And you don't even necessarily realize it when you're applying for a job or whatever else, but companies are doing all sorts of things to avoid having disparate impact lawsuits. So in addition, we've had the growth of the administrative state. And the growth of the administrative state has ensured that the administrative state's the bureaucracy, just another word for the bureaucracy. And they've made all sorts of rules because they're experts. I can tell you, I had 10,000 people working under me at the Department of Interior, and probably 9,995 of them were trying to undermine me. So, like, they can do all sorts of things, and they did. And that's partially because the civil rights bureaucracy has been totally captured by the radical left in this country. Okay, so they just do what they want, and they're sort of extremist left when the Democrats are running things, and they're only far left when the Republicans are running things. And that's kind of the thing. And even when you have a really good commissioner of civil rights, like the gentleman who endorsed my book, who's been there for years as a Republican and fights on these issues, there's only limits to what they can do. So how does this manifest itself? We have employment discrimination. We have discrimination in college admissions. In theory, this has been eliminated by this recent Supreme Court decision that said that's illegal. I think we can look at what happened in California, which declared this sort of thing illegal years ago. It will do some things, but I think it will largely, unfortunately, just be ignored unless we have a really strong government to fight back against it. But beyond that, there's a lot of informal types of discrimination. So in terms of a critique of the civil rights, I don't want to relitigate the Civil Rights Act. I think it did a lot of things that were necessary at the time. But I just point out that there's as much time between where we are today and this, when the Civil Rights Act passed, as between them and the Wright brothers. So I think we just have a different set of challenges that we're facing in America today, and that this law, as written, doesn't really address those problems very well. So now I'm going to get into some of the subjects, and I'm just going to go through these quickly so that we have some time to talk. So on crime, again, there's this sort of, I spent a lot of time on this, there's these huge mythical statistics about white on black crime and whatever, but just to be really clear, whites are overwhelmingly, not just with respect to African Americans, but with respect to every other group except for Asian Americans, which the numbers are just really small in both directions, they're the victims of interracial crime and not the perpetrators of them. So murders since 1968, interracial murders, there have been 193,000, 75% of them black on white, 98% of interracial rape murders. You have these hate crime hoaxes. We saw what happened with Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha, where he was accused, including by a member of Congress, without any evidence at all, of sort of being a white supremacist because he shot a bunch of white guys, thankfully for him, I think, which is why he was ultimately acquitted. Who were all convicted felons multiple times, defending himself. And meanwhile, you kind of also had the Trayvon Martin case, for those of you who can remember back that far. I think that was really the thing that in 2013 started the original Black Lives Matter movement. The rarity of police killings of unarmed African Americans, if you ask liberals to estimate how often that happens, it's thousands of times per year. The true number is about 10 to 12 per year, okay, which given the number of people in both of those categories is really small. We have what's called the hunt for the great white defendant. This is a phrase from Tom Wolfe, if any of you ever read the book Bonfire of the Vanities. To me, Wolfe was probably the greatest conservative writer of the second half of the 20th century. Would highly recommend you read that or one of his other books. But he kind of talked about this idea of these prosecutors always looking for like this wealthy white defendant they could go after because it was a lot sexier than saying, hey, you know, I'm going after a Hispanic guy who's committed a crime. And so essentially a lot of this, whites are a victim, in my view, of effectively what's called a blood libel. You know, they're being blamed for a bunch of interracial crime and incitement, and Trump was also did that with, you saw a lot of the interracial violence against Asian Americans in the wake of COVID. It was blamed on Trump having said Kung Flu or whatever, but literally, I mean, but if you, and this was by prominent members of the Asian American community, but if you look at what was happening, it was just a continuation of the same old African American on Asian American violence that had been epidemic before then and just increased. But white people were blamed for it. Real estate, so I talk about white flight. This is probably the most provocative chapter of the book, I think, for people who read it carefully. I kind of argue this is the only form of ethnic cleansing for which the victims were blamed. So in other words, and this is true of my family. I mean, my family's from industrial cities in the Midwest. They essentially had to leave their homes and communities, not because they had some huge racial animus, but because it became completely unsafe physically with crime, with violence in schools, with everything else. And again, I document that a lot. It also, by the way, I mean, it drove out the minority middle class. You began to see some of the same things, particularly in the Detroit area, cities like Southfield, the African-American middle class, as things got really violent there, they just left, right? So I talk a little bit about blockbusting, which is sort of some of the things that happened, and then the kind of brutal crime regime that happened for those who left behind. And I talk about Biden and forced busing. And again, for some of you who are older, this was a live issue. I was actually bused. I didn't know that when I was a kid, but I was, to a school for racial balancing. Interestingly enough, Joe Biden in the 1970s, the thing he was known for most was his opposition to forced school integration through busing. He was like the big champion of that issue. He worked with Jesse Helms. For those of you who remember who Jesse Helms was, sort of arch conservative senator from North Carolina, they would do bipartisan bills on busing. Now this, the media has conveniently written out this chapter of Joe Biden's political biography because it doesn't really tell a story they want to do. But it just shows you how much American politics has changed. So I talk about schools and interracial violence in schools, and again, whites overwhelmingly the victim of that, and I have lots of data on that. Poor educational outcomes, falsely blamed on lack of funding. Montana is a classic example of that. I mean, my school district in Bozeman, which is probably, I have five kids in school, probably one of the best funded districts in the state, I would imagine. I think we're slightly under the national average and like a third of what a kid in Harlem would be getting. So there's a notion that like poor minority students, their schools are not being funded, and that's why they're not good. That's just not true when you look at the data. I note that it's not a coincidence that the Supreme Court case that knocked down affirmative action at last was brought on behalf of Asian American students rather than white students. That suggested that the attorneys, and I think correctly, decided that to appeal to an all-white conservative Supreme Court block, the thing that would appeal to them more than having a white defendant would be to have an Asian American defendant. And that tells you a lot about racial dynamics today. Just to give you a sense of like how extreme the discrimination is, the SAT gap between an admitted white and black student at a place like Harvard, or sorry, the University of North Carolina, which was the second plaintiff, was the equivalent SAT gap, or ACT as we'd have here, between a student who got into Harvard and one who went to Ohio State. So there are huge, huge gaps, huge, huge levels of discrimination. We've had the erasure of history. I'm trying to move quickly here because I want to, I've been threatened to not leave, kind of end too late. We've had more than 140 monuments come down of various types. The Confederate ones have gotten most of the attention, but in no means has it been exclusively this. You see again here the vanguard, Thomas Jefferson, rather an important person in American history with, I would argue, a pretty good legacy, had his statue removed from New York City Hall after 187 years. So we had Columbus statues. I'm not gonna have time to get into the Marsha P. Johnson thing. You can buy the book and read it. Monticello and Montpelier. Montpelier is James Madison's home in Virginia. I kind of document like what it's like to take a tour of these homes now, in which basically the people who lived there, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, kind of important people in American history, are basically vilified throughout the tour that you take. So we also kind of erase just how white America was in history to kind of match our multicultural ideology. And again, I kind of go into statistically, you know, in 1950 or something, 19 states were 98% white. So it's not that other people were being erased. It was just that like that really was the history, you know, for better and worse. I have a chapter on entertainment. I talk about white men are stupid in commercials. That's a nice Twitter feed. Can literally read, again, it's just like, these are the sorts of things that happen subliminally. You're not even realizing necessarily that you're consuming it. But there is a trope, and it's even, people in the industry will talk about it, of like, you have the stupid white guy in the commercial, and he's the person you make fun of. And he, you know, then the minority comes in and makes, you know, kind of fixes the problem. I have statistics on how minorities have actually been portrayed more positively than whites on average in Hollywood since 1960s. I talk about color-conscious casting that's going on right now. There's also ridiculous, like you have to basically disregard the Academy Awards now in terms of who's winning them because there are the most absurd racial quotas, again, I don't have time to get into them, that you could imagine that you have to have before you can even be eligible for an Academy Award today. This is just something that's happened in a few years. This is the musical Hamilton. kind of the big popular musical of the last few years. Actually a really good musical artistically, and I say that in the book, but also has huge anti-white undertones within it that kind of everybody just sort of says, oh, well, that's okay. Talk about the whiteness of the Green Movement. Sierra Club, oldest, most reputable. By the way, that rainbow flag there is not a coincidence on the Sierra Club logo. That's a new innovation. Just totally unhinged. I mean, so this is the oldest environmental group in the country. They are tearing down and kind of refuting their association with John Muir, who kind of founded the Sierra Club. I would say this is like the US disavowing George Washington, but it's actually way more extreme than that. It just gives you a sense of how completely off the rails these organizations have gone. And what's Muir's crime? I mean, Muir, by the standards of his day, was a racial progressive, but by the standards of 2024, he was not a racial progressive. And so kind of in this, you know, the environmental movement is very white, okay? It just is. I mean, I've worked in and around it. I know this. To kind of compensate that in this mind for that, they go through this ridiculous self-flagellation like you see here. And then climate policy, again, I'm just touching on this briefly, is an international reparations plan. We just touched on climate. I mean, again, I have a whole separate life where I've written a ton of climate policy. And essentially, it's being used as a transfer from majority white nations to other nations. Big business and big tech. So there's all sorts of anti-white discrimination that went on at Google. Some of it is very overt. It hasn't kind of gotten in the media. But when it comes out through the courts, it's going to be shown, as it already has been in affidavits that people haven't paid attention to, that HR people were basically told, like, don't hire white people. Like, that's the level of blatantness that was, and it was okay, right? Like, everybody thought that was okay, except that this one HR guy then decided, you know, hey, that's not okay, and then they filed a lawsuit. But the culture was, that's okay. Massive big tech payoffs to Black Lives Matter. We documented this at Claremont. It went into the hundreds of millions of dollars. If you go to our website, we kind of document where it went. I'm sorry, I'm just sort of zooming through here, so I'm gonna kind of go through the rest. Unhealthy disrespect. So we had racist orders, including in Montana, by the way, although about the order for when you could get a COVID vaccine. Now, I'm sure here we have different views about like the efficacy of the COVID vaccine, but at least I can tell you the people who were giving you the COVID vaccine thought that it, or a lot of them at least, thought it was a life-saving thing. And there was an overt racial hierarchy in some states in terms of where you could get it. Even though the risk might, like if you were a 70-year-old white person and you were at higher risk, you would be at a lower priority than a 40-year-old Hispanic person in some states. Again, this got very little attention, but it did happen. In journals, whites were not allowed to write on minority health matters. They had to do minority scholars. Tuskegee syphilis experiment, which is kind of like the most notorious racist medical experimentation that ever happened, where they essentially allowed untreated syphilis, largely a myth. Not entirely a myth, but largely a myth. There have actually been some very good debunking of this. And sort of other things. So I'm kind of racing through here. So we have the anti-white military. We have racial equity in military promotions. We have racist hiring command that's required. Diversity has now been identified as a strategic imperative. There are many people who have pointed out the consequences of doing that. And by the way, one of the interesting things when you read kind of a lot of the people who tried to blow the whistle about this within the military, a lot of it was non-white soldiers who said, you know, you and sailors or airmen who are saying you are totally destroying unit cohesion by trying to break us up by race in this way. So that's actually the people who ended up blowing the whistle on a lot of this. But again, I go into big detail about this in the book, but I'm just touching on it right now. So what's the result? In the last 5 years, white recruitment to the military, while everybody else's main flat, is down like 40%. So why is that an even bigger problem? Guess who is disproportionately at the tip of the spear in the military? Like, who's more likely to be in the special forces in dangerous combat roles? It's the same people we're telling, like, we're not going to give you a fair shake in the military. Probably not the smartest idea. So the end game, I'm going to talk about this a lot more tomorrow, but it's reparations and expropriation. I think that's the real goal here. It's to create the intellectual justification, all of this, to expropriate resources from whites. You can't just go do that, right? Because that doesn't feel acceptable. So you need to create an intellectual atmosphere where people feel like that's a just outcome. And all of this stuff in all these areas, I kind of argue, and again, I don't just say it, I give evidence for it in the book. That's what this is ultimately about. So I'll talk about how we fix that tomorrow. And then finally, I've got just a couple minutes, so where can you find me? I'm at RealJeremyCarl on X/Twitter pretty frequently. I have a Substack. I'd almost as much like you to sign up for that if you're at all interested. The Course of Empire, it's brand new. I publish on there, try to every week. And then I write for a bunch of conservative publications as well.